Josh does clock. He gets a hand on and slows down. Game point number one. Mike Dodd with a fabulous dig, and then the shot off Karch Kirai. We're headed for the double final. Dodd and Whitmarsh win the game to 15. Double final action coming up from San Francisco for the championship.
Hey guys, and welcome back to the Paper Courts Podcast. I am your host, Travis Mawerder, per usual. And today, before we get to the podcast, I want to do a little news update for the beach volleyball world. So it is now Super Bowl Monday, which means obviously, forget baseball season, it's beach volleyball season. And we do have our first FIVB Grand Slam this week down in Fort Lauderdale. It's kind of a bummer that the AVP didn't stop by Florida, so at least they're getting a little bit of love on the FIVB tour. So we have our number one team, Phil Dahlhauser, Nick Lucena, Tribe Bourne, and John Hayden. We have the new partnership of Jake Gibb and Taylor Crabb. And then for our fourth, so Casey Patterson and Theo Bruner actually had to get a wild card bid into the main draw here, which I think that goes to show how competitive U.S. volleyball is right now, that we had an Olympian, Casey Patterson, needing a wild card to get in. We also have Trevor Crabb and Sean Rosenthal in the qualifier, and Stafford Slick and Billy Allen in the qualifier as well, so we could have six American teams competing. But now for the podcast, my interview here today is with Mike Dodd, the 1996 silver medalist and winner of five Manhattan Beach Opens. We'll talk about the Olympics. We'll talk about the importance of Manhattan. We'll talk about how he was a professional basketball player. Yes, he was drafted by the San Diego Clippers. And then we'll talk about how he got into beach volleyball. So listen in, and I appreciate y'all listening as always.
When I finished with high school, I was, ranked AAA. I had the highest rating you could have on the beach. But I wanted to be a professional athlete, so I went to San Diego State on a basketball scholarship. Because volleyball at that time was just really something you did for fun and for pride, but it was definitely a big, big part of our culture here in the South Bay.
And now, when you went to San Diego State, you ended up getting drafted by the Clippers, right?
Uh-huh.
And so you wanted to be a professional athlete, and here you are, you get drafted by the Clippers. So how did you end up going from, having a potential NBA contract to getting into beach volleyball professionally?
Well, it was just a process. I tried out with the Clippers, and I made it pretty far, but not far enough, and so I ended up getting cut. And so at the time that I got cut, I had two options. I could go to Europe and play basketball in Germany. I'd been offered a contract for a team over there, and I'd also gotten a call from the volleyball coach at San Diego State, who offered, they were just starting to do this thing they have now where you can play a fifth year in a different sport. So he had offered me a scholarship to go back to San Diego State and play volleyball. And it just seemed like I had really given basketball my all, but after I got cut by the Clippers, I really felt like, I needed to kind of get back to volleyball and see how far I could go in that sport. So it was just one of those decisions. I decided to do my fifth year at San Diego State, and then I got invited to play on the national team. And, and then Tim Hovland and I just kind of started playing together after practice, indoor practices on the beach, because Karch and Sinjin needed someone to practice against. And then we just, started, the whole beach thing just grew and grew and grew. And both Tim Hovland and myself had a really interesting lifestyle. We left the national team to play professionally indoors in Italy. And so we would play indoor professional volleyball and for these club teams, and then we would come home and we would play professional beach volleyball, and you know, after 4 or 5 years of playing in Italy, the beach had grown to so many more tournaments, and the schedule was so much longer that we could do that full time. So it just, the timing couldn't have been better.
Yeah, that's not a bad gig you found for yourself there.
No, it was, and the indoor in Italy and the experience of that, and then just being able to kind of, you know, come back in the summer and play beach volleyball and kind of heal all your wounds from the indoor. It was really a great time in our lives, I think.
I bet. And when I was reading Sinjin's book, it seems like it was a lot different than it is today. Because today, you know, you'll see the guys come out for about, you know, 2.5 hours, and they'll just sort of drill. You know, there'll be 6 of them, and they'll just get as many reps in as possible. But the way Sinjin describes it in his book is that, you know, it was guys would just go out there and just play all day long. So was that kind of the lifestyle back then, that it would just be you guys
would
head out to the beach and it would just put you sign up on court one and just wait for your turn and see how long you can hold the court down?
Yep. Yeah, it was exactly that way. And it was really, we were kind of the last era of the old school of that lifestyle. And then all of a sudden, you know, the internet came along and cell phones, and all of a sudden people had too many other things to do. So they started, you know, bringing down combs and a million balls and doing drills and, you know, spending a couple hours playing and practicing and doing drills. And it was just a different thing, you know.
Right. And now with the, so I guess you saw volleyball before the AVP, and then you saw it as the AVP was forming. And I know that there had been some unrest and buildup, you know, for between you guys forming the AVP, and that it ultimately the last straw seemed to be when they switched to the Mikasa ball without really asking you guys. So tell me a little bit about how the AVP went about forming. And
well,
I guess,
the AVP, that was, there was a group called, actually their name was, I think, Group Dynamics, and they were promoters, and they were putting on the first few professional beach tournaments, and they had a world championship in the Saltwater Lagoon in Redondo Beach. And you know, we were just playing and having a great time and kind of loving life, and then, you know, at a certain point, where it started to grow, and all of a sudden there was TV, and there was more and more sponsorship money. As a group of players, we were kind of getting curious, like, what's the breakdown, you know? What else coming in, and what are we getting for prize money? Because, you know, we're kind of putting the show on. And so the people that, at Group Dynamics, we're very against kind of sharing the information as far as what all the money was coming in and whatnot. And then kind of some animosity was growing and distrust and just kind of, you know, I don't know how to describe it, but it was brewing. And then when they signed a big deal with Mikasa, and we had to play with this ball that was just very inferior to the leather natural balls that we had been playing with all our lives, it was kind of the last straw. So then a guy named Leonard Armato, who was a he had played beach volleyball and was an accomplished athlete agent. He represented a lot of professional athletes. He got together with a group, you know, the bulk of our player group, and you know, we tried to again kind of work out and get information and from the promoters, and they didn't. So at a certain point, I think it was in 1983. We, as a group, decided to not play in in their world championship and form, and that's when the AABC formed. All of that kind of came together all at the same time as far as us deciding to kind of boycott that world championship and form our own players association. And, you know, we're pretty successful as a group at being united. A couple of good players, not the very, very top players, ended up kind of breaking through the line and playing in that tournament. But the result ended up that the following year, a lot of the sponsorship contracts and everything kind of started to all flow through the AABC and our players association. So in that respect, it was a very, very successful kind of transition as far as us as a player group really being, by United, being able to gain a lot of control of our sport and how it was sold and marketed and the rules and the equipment and everything. We, you know, from the get-go, the following year, had complete control over all of those aspects.
How tough was it to sit out of the World Championships? I'm sure that that while you guys were presenting a united front, that there was still a little bit lingering in the back of your mind, like, man, these are the World Championships.
Yeah, it was really tough. I mean, it was by far the most money, you know, that was offered in any tournament. And, you know, there was a lot of it at stake. But I think as a group of athletes, as a player group, I would say that we're all, you know, college educated and pretty, we were pretty aware of what was at stake. So for, you know, I mean, the guys that were sacrificing the most were the very top players, Vincent Smith and Randy Stoklos and Kurt Kurai and Tim Hovland, and they were the at the forefront of the movement. So, you know, it was tough, but it wasn't really that tough because we knew we had a really good idea of what we were fighting for, and it was worth it. So, you know, yeah, it stung, but the sting was nothing compared to, you know, the fruit that came forward after.
And so how were the earlier days of the AABC? I'm sure that, you know, with any startup business or tour, you know, what have you, that there's always a couple bumps along the way. So how was the AABC when you guys first started running your own tournaments? I'm sure that there was a couple growing pains to go along with it.
You know, if there were, as players, we certainly didn't experience it. I mean, I was on the player board and I was very involved. And Leonard Armato was an incredible promoter and businessman and salesman. And, you know, to be honest with you, we hit the ground running. I mean, we, every year after 84, when we first started putting on events, we increased the number of events, the amount of prize money. You know, we started with Jose Cuervo and kind of a loosey-goosey little TV deal with a company called Prime Ticket that since became Time Warner and a lot of other companies. And it grew. We took on Miller Lite. We ended up doing a deal with NBC. You know, probably the biggest snag came, you know, 4 or 5 years down the line. I don't know the exact chronology, but at a certain point, Leonard Armato was the chief executive of our players association, but he was also representing Tintin and Randy, and Tintin was the president, and it just got there was a little too much crossover, and so there was a vote, and Leonard was voted kind of out, and we hired another guy, Jeff Dankworth, and Finjan was really upset, and there was some bad blood, and, you know, but this guy that we hired, Jeff Dankworth, really kind of was the architect of the NBC Miller Lite deal, where Miller Lite just basically funded our whole tour and all the expenses and all the insurance and security and tents and trucks and you name it. We were really doing well at that time. We had control of our own concessions, and we were just doing the simple tour hats and t-shirts and sweats and just selling out everywhere we go, and it was kind of a rough transition from Leonard to Jeff Dankworth, as far as, you know, kind of creating a lot of animosity with Finjan Smith but for the whole tour, it was unbelievable. I mean, after that, we had a Grand Prix, and we had a $1 million player pool, and, you know, we had over 20 tournaments a year and more live network coverage than hockey and tennis combined, and we were on an absolute roll. So
it sounds like it.
Yeah, I mean, really, from the moment that we had the strike to really, you know, the moment that in 97 that it was apparent that the guy that we had hired after Jeff Dankworth, this guy Jared Solomon, had run our tour into the ground and we were going to be bankrupt. You know, from the moment of 83 to 97, it was just every year was better and better.
And now for a quick commercial break.
Check out mobilebeachcoach.com if you're interested in having your match footage analyzed by the pros.
And now, back to the show.
And when did, do you know how the Olympic Games, how beach volleyball ended up becoming an Olympic sport? Because I'm sure that with how big it was becoming in the States, and obviously it was becoming big in countries like Brazil and elsewhere, that you know, the ABP was, I'm sure, was contacted in some part, you know, saying, hey, you know, can this be an Olympic sport?
Right.
And did you guys have any part in that?
You know, there's a lot of different, you know, I don't know exactly how it all came about. I have a pretty good feeling that at some point, Ruben Acosta, who was then the president of the FI, the International Volleyball Federation, I think he came and saw a Manhattan Open, and he saw how big the crowds were and how the Strand and the Pier kind of all went to create this natural arena. And he saw, I think he got the first inkling of just how big beach volleyball could be. And then I know Finjan had a lot to do with it. He was, you know, after kind of the acrimonious breakup with Leonard Armato and him losing his position as president, he really, you know, kind of spent a lot more of his time and focus on the international tour and building that. And I know he had a lot to do with it becoming a sport. But for me, the biggest thing that the FIVB did that was really smart was how they positioned beach volleyball, because they basically added beach volleyball. They didn't create a new sport, which takes all kinds of trials and tests, runs and all this other, and years and years and years and years before they become an official Olympic sport. What they did was they added beach volleyball, just like swimming or track, add a new race, like a relay or a different distance or something different added to the track, competition. They added beach volleyball as simply, another event of volleyball. Atlanta in 96. And before we get to talking about Atlanta, which obviously, you know, you were a silver medalist and everything, you mentioned Manhattan and that that might have been one of the initial draws. And, you know, you, as far as Manhattan goes, I don't know if anyone has had more success both as a player and a coach than you. So I'm sure that Manhattan has a pretty special place in your heart.
Absolutely, it does. Yeah.
Makes it just such an unbelievable volleyball tournament? Because I finally played in my first one this past year, and a couple of my buddies from Maryland were in town, and they had never seen a beach volleyball tournament. They're like, holy cow, this is really cool. And
yeah,
obviously, you know, it's just like the crowd and everything, but I mean, you've seen Manhattan Beach Open since, you know, 1980, maybe. And so,
yeah,
you know, what makes this tournament arguably the best tournament in the world outside is not even better than the Olympics?
Well, I just think I think you start with the history and the tradition of the tournament, you know. It has been, since it ever started, the tournament that had the biggest crowd, the best setup, the best court, the nicest everything. So from even in the 1950s, anyone that played beach volleyball, that was your Olympics. That was your pinnacle, you know, was to win a Manhattan Open, because it was always the toughest tournament with the biggest field and the most tradition and all those factors. Then you throw in, you know, I forget when they started doing it, but they started putting plaques on the pier for the winners of the Manhattan Open. And I think any athlete just naturally, you know, you want to be great and you want to succeed and hopefully have some financial reward or whatever. But more than anything, you just want to be remembered, you know, as a great player, as someone that had something to do with this game. And so I think that was also the fact when they started putting the flats up on the pier, you know, it was a way for a volleyball player to really, you know, put something that's going to have them be remembered. You know, you want to be remembered. And so this was an unbelievable incentive, again, for players to really want to do well and kept building kind of the legacy of the tournament. You know, and then you get, you know, the full circle to the Olympics, which is an even greater kind of, you know, opportunity for you to not be immortalized, but to know that if you do something in an Olympics, you know, you're part of history. You'll as long as, you know, the world keeps spinning and people are here, they'll know the history of the Olympics and your name will be part of that. So it's a huge deal. You know, it's just, so the Manhattan Open was our Olympics until the Olympics happened, and then, you know, the Olympics are the Olympics, and they're something that nothing can really compare to. But the Manhattan Open just keeps going on, kind of like the Masters, you know. All of a sudden now there's the FedEx Cup and $10 million and this and that, and, you know, the PGA Tour has done a great job of creating more and more kind of marquee events. But still, I think in the heart of a lot of players, you know, there's the Masters or a British Open or a U.S. Open. You know, one of those real kind of majors is what they were shooting for when they were growing up, not to win $10 million in a FedEx Cup.
That's a good comparison. And you won your first Manhattan Open when you were pretty young, right? I have it. It was 1982. Was that your first,
yes,
first win of many?
Uh-huh.
And how old were you in 82 then?
Well, let's see. I think I was 25.
So you're pretty precocious to win the Manhattan Open at 25.
did you realize what you, like, the magnitude of the moment when you were in it? Or was it one of those things where, you know, it takes a little bit of time and you look back on it and you're like, holy cow, you know, I won my first of five Manhattan Opens when I was 25 years old.
You know, I never really thought of it as I never felt like I was, you know, I certainly didn't feel like a prodigy or anything. I mean, but Karch is younger than I am, and he was probably winning Manhattan Opens when he was 18 or 19. You know, so the fact that I played a lot of, you know, I actually felt, you know, like I would never want to change anything, but I really felt like I left a lot of Opens and Manhattan Opens and tournaments on the shelf when I played 4 years of basketball and just kind of stopped playing volleyball altogether. So, you know, when I was, you know, 15, 16, I was AAA. I was, you know, in one Manhattan Open, I think, when I was like a sophomore in high school, and I played with my brother. We got the number one seed, 14-11. So I think I could have won some other Manhattan Opens, you know, had I just gone straight into volleyball out of high school. But I wouldn't change anything for the world. So I guess it's a long-winded way of saying that when I won a Manhattan Open at 25, I did not feel at all like a prodigy or that I was young or anything, because I know so many other players that had won it at such a younger age.
Right. And then you won it the next year, and then the next year, I think you won a couple in a row. And like, when have you kind of gone back to look at the pier and be like, hey, you know, there's me. Like, how cool is it to be, like you said, immortalized on the pier? And for you, it's five times. Like, when you walk up and down the pier, you're like, man, that's pretty cool. Does it ever get old?
No, I can honestly say it never gets old, and it's really fun. Not just to see my name and my partner Tim Hovland's name, but to see everybody's names and to see, you know, the old players and the new players, and, you know, certainly beach volleyball has had its ups and downs, and you know, but the kind of the soul of the game will always be there, whether or not it's marketed and packaged the right way or wrong, that's always something to be debated. But kind of the soul of the game and the fact that this tournament still means so much to Jake Gibb and Phil Dalhauser and all the great players that are contemporary and part of the game now, that says a lot for the tournament.
Yeah. And now, moving on to Atlanta a little bit, like you said, you know, Manhattan may have been the impetus to get beach volleyball, at least the discussions for beach volleyball in the Olympics, and then you go out in Atlanta and take silver. And so how was it as an Olympic sport? I mean, was it a vindicating moment for you guys? Because, you know, only, you know, about a dozen years before, you guys were pushing for the MVP, and then, you know, 12 years later, it's on the biggest stage, biggest sporting stage on the planet.
Yeah. No, it was, you know, it was really, you know, as it turns out, as far as a springboard to our sport or something along that line, the Olympics has never really panned out with that respect. I think, you know, obviously, it didn't, seeing as our tour failed 1 year after the first Olympics, and the fact that we had a gold and silver medal in that Olympics, it couldn't overcome what had been more just bad business planning and whatnot. But, you know, I can only speak for myself personally, and you know, when I can go back to the days that Tim Hovland and myself decided to leave the national team and become professional. You know, the Olympics was something I thought
no, well, that's one of the things that is not going to be in the cards for me. And then even, you know, I was almost 40 when I won that medal. You know, I really didn't think the Olympics was ever going to be part of my deal. And then all of a sudden, literally in the blink of an eye, there was an announcement that beach volleyball was going to be an Olympic sport and that we were going to have a trials and this and that. And, you know, I had to play in the qualifier for the trials. I had to play in the trials, and my partner, Mike Whitmarsh, and I prevailed in all of those just unbelievably tough events leading up to the Olympics. And so then, you know, to be walking in that arena, it was just so surreal and so new and so unexpected for me that I just, and the fact that I was older and that I'd been through just about everything you could go through in beach volleyball, you know, it was really something that I just cherished. I knew the chances are of me returning to the Olympics were not good at all, and the fact that I was able to make it was really not a miracle, but it was a really, really incredible achievement that I was super proud of, and I just like soaked up and enjoyed every second of the experience. And it, and then later on, as you know, coaching Olympic teams in the Olympics, it was one of my kind of cornerstone messages was don't treat this like it's just another tournament, because it's not. It's something completely different, and if you just embrace it and accept it for, you know, all of the intense pressure and everything that comes with it and all the excitement, and just kind of embrace it instead of trying to, you know, slough it off or ignore it, you're going to do a lot better, you know. So that was my attitude going into it. I just soaked up every ounce of Olympic core and loved every second of it.
That will conclude part one of my interview with Mike Dodd. You'll be able to catch part two this weekend. And thanks again to all of you guys for listening. As always, for all of my friends down in Florida, enjoy the Grand Slam. I'm jealous that I won't be able to watch, but I'm sure that y'all will keep me posted. Thanks, as always, to our sponsors, Bulldog Beach Volleyball and Mobile Beach Coach and Andrew Dentler. And I will catch y'all on the weekend.